I think we're going to start. We are waiting for a few more folks before we have a quorum, but you can present, and then if you just, I'll give you this, and then I'll officially start the meeting when I get enough folks. So I can't move the bill yet, but if you'd like to start talking about House File 2132, that would be great.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Thank you for the opportunity to present House File 2132 today. This is a local bill exclusively for the Washington County Housing and Redevelopment Authority, and it is co-authored by the entire Washington County legislative delegation. Before I present the bill, I have an amendment that I would like to have someone move to get the bill in order. It is the A1 amendment.
Representative Omar, we don't have a quorum yet, so we can't move your bill or your amendment.
Okay.
But you can talk about it.
Okay.
And then once we get enough members here, I will do all that.
All right, very good. So the Washington County HRA was established by special law in 1974. It's not codified in statute. House File 2132 will confirm the current enabling law of the Washington County HRA to continue to function as it always has, with the authority and jurisdiction of a county housing and redevelopment authority, as established in Minnesota Statute 469. So here to describe the bill is Ms. Barbara Dacey, Executive Director of the Washington County HRA.
Welcome to the committee, and if you could identify yourself for the record.
You bet. My name is Barbara Dacey. D-A-C-Y. D as in dog, A-C-Y. I'm the Executive Director for the Washington County Housing and Redevelopment Authority. Madam Chair and members, the proposed bill is essential to clarify that the Washington County HRA is indeed a county housing and redevelopment authority under Minnesota Statute Chapter 469. The impact of the bill is simply to maintain the status quo, and it preserves the longstanding cooperative relationship between the cities in the county and the county HRA. As Representative Lomer just stated, the Washington County HRA was originally created through special law in 1974 under the Municipal Housing and Redevelopment Statute. So the proposed changes in Section 1 of the bill simply update the special law to confirm that the Washington County HRA is, in fact, a county housing and redevelopment authority under Minnesota Statutes Chapter 469. Section 2 of the proposed bill is to confirm the HRA's existing practice to clearly state that the jurisdiction and area of operation of the county HRA includes all of the communities within the county, whether or not they have a city HRA. 29 out of the 33 communities in the county do not have HRAs, but 4 do. Resolutions from each of the 4 have been obtained, and they support and acknowledge the Washington County HRA area of operation and jurisdiction, and I have copies of those available should any of you request those. The amendment, you will note, clarifies the proposed language in Section 2 of the bill to require municipal approval should the county HRA propose a project and a location within a municipality. So, Chair and members, in closing, the Washington County HRA is merely bringing the special law in line with current practice, and the bill will maintain the status quo. Thank you.
Thank you. We do now have a quorum, so the Government Operations and Elections Committee will officially come to order. Representative Quam, have you had time to review the minutes?
Yes, I have reviewed the minutes, and I move that we approve them.
Representative Quam moves approval of the Wednesday, February 22nd minutes. Is there any discussion or changes? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Minutes are approved. Now I will move. Representative Lomer, would you like me to move your bill, or did you have someone else? Should I move your bill?
Please.
Okay, I will. Is it the General Register?
Yes.
I will move that House File 2132 be recommended to pass and be placed on the General Register. Further, I will move approval of the A1 amendment. We already heard about the A1 amendment, so does anybody have any questions before we vote on the A1 amendment? Seeing no questions, all those in favor of the A1 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Okay, now we've got the bill properly moved in the shape you'd like, and did you have further witnesses or? Nope. Okay, members. Anyone have any questions for the author or testifiers? Seeing no questions, I'll renew my motion that House File 2132 be recommended to pass as amended and be placed on the General Register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion does prevail. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Now we're going to have a virtually identical bill with Representative Detmer. I'm just taking these a little out of order because these are so similar. Welcome to the committee. Representative Detmer, would you like me to move your bill?
Yes, Madam Chair. Please move my bill. And I have an amendment, too. So.
Okay. I will move House File 2392 be recommended to pass and be placed on the General Register. And I got to look through to find your...
Madam Chair, we have the A2 amendment.
Okay, just hold on a second. Okay, I will move the A2 amendment. Would it be all right if we pass the amendment so that the bill gets in the shape the author would like? Seeing no questions, all in favor of approval of the A2 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Amendment is approved, and now the bill is in the shape you'd like. To your bill.
Yes, Madam Chair and committee members, the House File 2392 is very similar to the one you just heard from Washington County. And with this bill, it also provides that the Anoka County Housing Redevelopment Authority, HRA, has jurisdictions and operates in the county. And to explain the bill, I would like to introduce Karen Skipper from Anoka County HRA, and she would like to maybe address any questions and talk about the legislation, the bill before you. Thank you.
Welcome, and if you could just identify yourself for the tape.
I'm Karen Skepper, S-K-E-P-P-E-R. I'm the Assistant Director of the Anoka County HRA. I'm here today to talk a little bit about the history of the Anoka County HRA. We too formed in the late 70s, as Washington County did. We had a slightly different practice than Washington County, however. We had many active HRAs in Anoka County at the time the county HRA was formed. And we did not levy a tax in any of the communities that had been established before our county HRA. There's a word in our enabling legislation that causes us a lot of trouble. It's the word is. Our legislation talks about we will operate in the county unless a housing authority was created by a municipality. And we want to make sure that we are able to have a time-specific date in there. So that the word is doesn't continue to cause us trouble. And what we would like to see is May 3rd, 2011, as the date where our county authority stands and allows us to maintain our taxing base to support our community projects, such as the 4 senior housing buildings that we have. We want to continue to work directly with the city and city HRAs that are very active. We are always welcome to partner with them and support their activities. In recent years, we have had two cities that have made the choice to join our county HRA to help allow us to work more closely on projects. And that's a very brief summary of what we're looking for today.
Thank you. Representative Skelzy.
Thank you, Ms. Chair, and I apologize for just a little bit of lateness, but how does the League of Minnesota Cities view this action that we're looking at today?
Ms. Skipper?
Madam Chair, committee members, we've had full support on the way our legislation is poised. Because we're not trying to change our practice and exert our authority in other communities, we've had no resistance at all or no concerns raised.
Do you have any other additional witnesses or anybody that wanted to testify to this bill? Any additional questions for members? Seeing no questions, I'll renew my motion that House File 2392 be recommended to pass as amended and be placed on the General Register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, nay. motion does prevail. Thank you. Next on the agenda, we will take Representative Mark Ward, House File 1708. Welcome to the committee, Representative Mark Ward.
Well, thank you very much, Madam Chair, for hearing this bill. So if someone would be nice enough to...
And where does your bill need to go?
Madam Chair, I don't know for sure where House File 1708 would go after this.
I'm thinking probably just the general register. Representative Green.
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd like to move the bill and move that we send it to the federal... I'm sorry, not federal. General register.
Good enough. So move. So, to your bill.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair and members. And again, thank you so much for hearing this bill. I'm very enthused about the possibilities about this bill. And, you know, 10 years ago, for any of you who are 4-H'ers, 10 years ago was the 100th year celebration of 4-H, and they had a national conversation around the nation, including the state of Minnesota. The number one key finding in there was to provide youth with a direct impact on legislation that impacts them at all levels of government. And so House File 1708, I believe, lives up to that. And what it would do is provide a direct link for youth into the legislative process, but also provides a direct connection for legislators to connect with youth on a very meaningful way that would provide youth with direct input, meaningful input, a meaningful voice into the process. And what this would do, you know, I know some are going to ask, well, why do we need to put this into law? There's 12 other states, at least, that was up till 2010, according to the National Council of State Legislatures. There's at least 12 other states that have this in the books of youth councils. But this would legitimize and formalize and kind of institutionalize youth input in the legislative process. So how would it work? It would set up a youth council that would have 36 members, four from each of the eight congressional districts and four at large, be from age 13 to 19, basically 8th grade through senior, two-year terms, limit of two terms, and so forth. The duties as basically giving youth input and a voice. But what's unique, if you go into the statute where we've created a youth advisory committee, is that you would have these 36 students from around the state that would actually sit in one of these committee rooms and around this committee room and listen to bills that are dealing with youth. They would request bills, ask legislators if they'd be willing to present those bills. They could also provide opinions on bills at a committee meeting twice a year. They also could propose and come up with youth bills, an omnibus youth bill, for example, that would be issues that really pertain to them. So what this does, it really moves youth input from lyceums and, you know, legislators going into classrooms and listening to actually having a legitimate and direct voice under the Capitol dome. We really think this would really provide something we don't have here right now. And not only would be a great benefit to youth so that we know what are they really thinking, what are the things they would like legislatively that impacts their unique generation. But also, I think this would create a more formalized way for us as legislators to really, you'd have at least twice a year, you would have a group of youth council members here discussing these type of bills. So I think it's a fantastic opportunity for youth, but for also for legislators and state overall. So we have some very enthusiastic testifiers, and Sarah Dixon here is the executive or the CEO and president of Minnesota Alliance with Youth, who would oversight this committee.
Okay. We do have one question for you, Representative Mark Ward. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Dixon, I think it
is?
Yes. Maybe you're going to say this, maybe I'm anticipating. Actually, I had a comment I was going to make first, but how many young people are involved in this statewide?
36 Ms. Dixon, is in the bill.
Pardon? Since you haven't spoken yet, if you could just identify yourself with tape before you answer the question.
Absolutely. Sarah Dixon with the Minnesota Alliance with Youth. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. There are 36, four from each congressional district and four at large. And we're right now recruiting to be at 36. We're probably about 25 right now.
Senator,
thank you, Madam Chair. Yesterday I did have someone actually from one of my district towns, Litchfield, come in and talk to me. I was impressed with her in the program. It seems like a good thing.
Well, thank you. I know she enjoyed meeting with you. She talked about it.
All good things.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, we'll move on to, okay. Did you want to speak, Ms. Dixon?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the opportunity to present with you this morning. We're very pleased to support this legislation. It really reflects our strong commitment to providing young people a voice, especially with legislators like yourselves, but also informing policy decisions, particularly those that impact youth directly. And a little bit about our background. Many of you might have heard of us in the past. We actually started in 1997 when all the living presidents and their wives held the President's Summit in Philadelphia in April of 1997, along with our national affiliate, America's Promise Alliance. And the goal of that summit was really to mobilize every sector of American life to invest in our nation's youth, build their character and competence through fulfilling five fundamental resources or five promises. That is actually a research-based framework by actually one of Minnesota's own, the late Dr. Peter Benson, that all young people need and deserve caring adults, safe places, marketable skills, a healthy start, and then opportunities to contribute, to lead, and to give back. And if young people have an abundance of these resources, research says that they're going to be much more likely to graduate from high school, enroll in college, have less negative behaviors like teen pregnancy or drug use. It's a very strong return on investment model. We know that the last year's class alone of dropouts, the loss of lifetime wages, total over more than $3.6 billion. The delegation that went to Philadelphia was led by the Lieutenant Governor Joanne Benson at the time, who served with Governor Arnie Carlson. She brought about 100 people to the summit, and when we returned, she convened even a larger group of Minnesotans. Thousands came to see how are we going to mobilize the goals of the summit in Minnesota. And because of her leadership, she was actually asked then to chair this initiative. And she said, I will do it with one condition. And that one condition was, I need to do it with a young person as an equal partner. Too oftentimes, she said that we see young people as recipients of services, as problems to fix, rather than as resources, as being amazing assets and resources that need to sit alongside adults in solving problems that impact them. So the Minnesota Alliance with Youth has embraced that vision ever since. We've been fortunate to work with all the lieutenant governors that have served since Joanne Benson. We currently work with Yvonne Pretner-Solon, lieutenant governor, as well as our youth co-chair, Esther Lee, is actually going to be speaking with you. And I'm very happy to say that most of the former lieutenant governors and our current lieutenant governor and youth co-chairs still serve on our board today. We believe that we are uniquely positioned to be the entity that hosts this statewide council. Because of our strong and diverse network of 500 strong, we work with schools and communities and organizations local and statewide across the state. We've had a long and successful history of hosting the Youth Council since 1997. We have the necessary funding and infrastructure to run a council such as this. We've already have a committed group, as Representative Erdahl said, that we already have a committed group of diverse youth and adults from across the state who really care deeply about this work. We have highly qualified staff, provide extensive training, have ongoing evaluation, really to measure impact and ensure we have ongoing and continuous improvement. We have long-standing relationships and bipartisan support with many elected officials and policymakers throughout the state. We're also part of a national youth policy council that really provides us cutting-edge research, best practices, policy briefs, to really support the work that we're doing to make sure that we're effective. And I also think, as Representative Marquardt said, this sort of proposed public-private partnership is really can be a stellar model national effort because of its innovative, cost-effective, sustainable approach. So we believe that that the Minnesota Alliance with Youth believes strongly that young people need to be at the table. We also believe the state of Minnesota needs young people at the table. We must invest in the voices of young people
today to ensure Minnesota continues to be the state that it is now, a vibrant, strong, economically solid state. So thank you so much for your time this morning and all your support.
Representative Hancock.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What we're establishing here is a youth council within the alliance. Is the alliance then bearing any cost of this?
Yes, we are. We provide the staffing and training, and so yeah, the cost is all on our behalf. So we're not asking for any financial support.
Okay. I guess my question would be: I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Is that going to then adversely affect the work of the alliance elsewhere because of the funding being diverted to the council?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, no, not at all. We've already got a line item budget that's fully board approved, and we've been running this council for several years, so there's no strain to us. In fact, we just received a large grant to support it, so we're excited about that.
Representative Marquardt.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Hancock asks an excellent question, and the reason why we think it's great to have it through the Minnesota Alliance with Youth is we already have a framework that's already, you know, there's an application form of about 5 pages long. I mean, the framework's already in place. There's no cost to the state. As you look through the legislation, the only kind of really involvement directly with the state would be that the minority and majority from House and Senate would appoint a legislative liaison, and then there could be staff. I'm thinking maybe an intern that could organize the meetings, but that's about it. We've got the framework and the group that's already doing this around the state already, so it's just, I think this is the excellent place to plug into.
Representative McFarland.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Marquardt, or Representative Marquardt. So am I to understand that the food and lodging transportation costs are all paid for by the foundations and private sector?
Representative Marquardt.
Madam Chair and Representative McFarland, that is correct.
Okay, and my second question would be, thank you, Madam Chair. How does this affect programs like Girls State, Boys State that the Legion has, and also the YMCA Youth and Government programs? Are we duplicating? Are we complementing? What are we doing here? I mean, kind of, I think there's a possibility for some partnerships of some of these things.
Madam Chair, and I think maybe Ms. Dixon could answer this better, but I do know, like, the Youth and Government is more of a mock legislature, rather than an ongoing, it's more of a mock exercise and so forth. But as far as those other connections, I think Ms. Dixon probably could answer that better.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. We definitely work with those organizations as well. One of our goals is to make sure we have representation. I know Orville, the state director for Youth and Government, certainly Boys and Girls State as well, really working with a lot of those associations and youth programs like Student Council, National Honor Society, to make sure we have representation from a variety of youth initiatives so that we do have that voice represented here.
I have a question. I'm not sure if this is for Representative Marquardt or Ms. Dixon. I noticed that there's no mention of any partisan breakdown, and I'm wondering if there's any attempt to make this, because obviously, depending on your political persuasion, your idea of good youth legislation may be different. I'm just wondering, I'm not suggesting you need to put it in the bill, but I'm just wondering what the if you'll be doing anything to make sure that you have a diverse group of students. Representative Marquardt.
Madam Chair, I think Ms. Dixon could answer that because they have an application process that's quite extensive, so maybe she could.
Ms. Dixon?
Answer that.
Yes, Madam Chair. Definitely we believe in bipartisan support. In fact, we have currently several on both sides of the aisle as far as Democrat and Republican young leaders. They don't vote currently. We work with 18-year-olds that start to vote. But that's not a requirement. I mean, it's not currently on the application to declare your party. That certainly could be something that we would look at. Right now, it's which congressional district do you live in. But I know firsthand, just because I know the young people, that we have strong Republicans, we have strong Democrats, and possibly some independents. I'm not aware of those. But
yeah,
we definitely want to, I guess our goal is really to have as diverse young people that serve on this council as possible.
Yeah, and I guess considering that would give a lot more credibility to
Madam Chair, if there could be some comfort language or even potentially maybe the legislators that would be appointed could have final look at the names or whatever. I mean, I'm certainly agreeable to that. I think that's a good point.
Okay, thank you. I guess we can move on to some of the student witnesses.
There are a couple students and are very enthusiastic. It'll be short, but Esther, if you would like to come first.
Welcome to the committee, and if you could just state your name for the record.
Yes, my name is Esther Lee, and I'm a senior at Chaska High School. First of all, I just want to say thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee, for having us here today. I've been on the Minnesota Youth Council for about 3 years now, and I am the current co-chair of the Minnesota Alliance with Youth Board of Directors. I have to say, going into college this fall is going to be bittersweet because I have to leave the Minnesota Youth Council. But for the past 3 years, it's been growing, and I'm just so proud of it. Through this council, I was humbled and I was matured, and I was able to just see the issues way beyond myself. And I was also able to see such wonderful, intelligent, passionate, and driven youth and supporters that were eager to create a better youth for the state of Minnesota and eventually this nation as well. The Minnesota Youth Council is a youth-led organization, but we also have that youth and adult collaboration as well. And the state-sponsored effort will make it possible for the effective and powerful youth voice to be heard across the state of Minnesota and also this nation as well. This bill will create sort of a solidified partnership to work closely with the state legislators and our youth as well. And we will guarantee that the youth issues will not be overlooked by our policies and decision-makings as well. Our youth ambassadors can provide state legislators with down-to-earth information and advice. And our council consists of such diverse members and fellows as well, both geographically and demographically. So each member has a story to tell. And so we're able to advise the state legislators for that. As you may know, the youth are such an important voice in the state of Minnesota, and the Minnesota Youth Council is a voice that we can't afford to tune out. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much. Next witness. Welcome to the committee. If you could just identify yourself for the tape.
All right. My name is Mona Muhammad, and thank you for giving me this opportunity to express my voice. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm here to tell my story. And I currently go to South St. Paul High School, and I'm a senior. And I'm ready to go to college and experience that community that you guys have all been through. And the idea of youth voice in Minnesota Youth Council, what I believe means is that an opportunity where youth can express themselves and to have a voice and the issues they believe in. And it's a place where they can say, my voice matters, and I can make a change in the lives of youth. And it could bring a different perspective on issues. And personally, through the Minnesota Youth Council, I was able to experience a whole new environment. Growing up as a child, I went to 3 different schools. I went to a private school that was predominantly Muslim, so I wasn't able to experience that diversity. And then at my second school that I went to, it was called International Middle School. And I was like, yes, it's going to be international. It's going to be all different kind of people. But I was wrong. It was predominantly Somali people, my own culture. And I was exposed to my own culture, but not other cultures. And then I went to South St. Paul High School, and it was predominantly Caucasian students, and I was the minority. So in my mind, I took a step back and just held back. And then I heard of the Minnesota Youth Council, and I was like, this might give me an opportunity to see the world in a different view and policy issues. And then, so the Minnesota Youth Council, personally, I believe, has provided me an environment of diverse students from different cultures and different parts of Minnesota. And we all came together to learn from one another and show our views and express ourselves and where no one can judge us. And it created a surrounding filled with students that are aspiring and they have a dedication for what they do. And Minnesota Youth Council had helped me give me a place where I can learn my speaking and communication skills, and they let me present activities where I can teach my fellow students about learning styles. And hopefully in the future when I go to college, I would be able to cope with the new environment in which I'm not familiar with. And Minnesota Youth Council had provided me a safe, secure family in which I am able to go back and look into, and they're always been there for me for the past 2 years. And thank you for having me.
Thank you. Thank you. Do you have any other witnesses?
Madam Chair, I have one further witness, if I might. So,
absolutely.
Ms. Kelly Tibby.
Welcome to the committee, and if you could just identify yourself for the record.
My name is Kelly Timian, and I'm an AmeriCorps Promise Fellow serving at Augsburg Fairview Academy. Good morning. I would like to thank you, Madam Chair, Senators, and Representative Members for having us here today. It is a privilege and a pleasure to be a part of the Minnesota Youth Council and an honor to watch our young people grow and learn from their experiences on the council. MYC is grounded in adult-youth partnerships and that foster creative collaboration and new ideas. By engaging youth and adults both as equal contributors in the decision-making process, we can find better and more effective solutions to the issues facing youth today. As an adult mentor for our MYC members representing Augsburg Fairview Academy, I can attest to the inherent value of interacting with youth as equal partners. Our youth have expressed that they truly believe they can affect change at both the local and statewide level because their opinion is valuable. Youth voice is incredibly important because it allows youth to play an active role in the legislative decisions that will have a direct impact on their lives. The goal of the MYC is to bridge the gap that exists between the youth whose lives are affected by legislation and the adults who create it. The passing of this legislation would demonstrate Minnesota's strong commitment to providing young people an authentic voice in the decisions that will impact their lives, their families, and ultimately their communities. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you. I just want to say I'm so impressed by the young people that came here today, particularly Ms. Lee and Ms. Mohammed. I think back to where I was in high school, and I wouldn't have had the nerve to come to the Minnesota Capitol to testify, and so your composure and grace under a little bit of pressure was heartwarming. Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, Madam Chair, not to pile on, but I would tell you that we see lots of testifiers that come before us, adults and people who speak for a living who weren't as articulate as you ladies were today. So thank you so much for being here, and it was a real pleasure for the committee to hear you today.
Does anybody else have questions? Anybody else need to testify? Okay, seeing none, Representative Green removes her motion that House File 1708 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, nay? Motion does prevail. Thank you.
Madam Chair and members, thank you so much. Appreciate that. Thank you.
Okay, we're going to take up House File 2174 and save 2169 for last. That's the bill that we had laid over a couple days ago. Members, while Representative O'Driscoll is making his way to the table, you might notice that there are two copies of 2174. The one in the packet is the incorrect version. There should have been one on the outside of your packet. The difference is the one that we should be looking at says first engrossment on the upper left-hand corner. So please reference House File 2174, first engrossment. Hey, Representative O'Driscoll, are you ready?
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. I move that House File 2174 be moved to the, be approved by the committee and moved to the general register today.
So moved. To your bill.
Madam Chair, the bill that we have before us is what I will call a technical correction. In the state of Minnesota, I'll step back, the federal government provides FDIC insurance on deposits of those institutions that are member organizations. The insurance for that deposit is paid by the financial institutions and is at no obligation to the state or federal government on this. What happens is we have products that are available out there right now in the private sector that allow for those depositors who aggregate over the FDIC insurance limits to be able to do what we would call account swaps to allow for the additional FDIC insurance of those funds that the current financial institution is unable to provide. Under law right now in the state of Minnesota, some of our local municipalities, cities, and counties have limited access to this tool. What this bill does is it allows banks in the state of Minnesota that offer FDIC insurance to be able to participate in this program if this bill becomes law. I have with us today Steve Davis, who will speak to how the process works. Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee, and if you could identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, Madam Chairman, committee members. I'm Steve Davis. I'm with Promontory Interfinancial Network. I live in Des Moines. Currently, through Minnesota Banks, we offer a program called CDERS, which is a certificate of deposit account system that keeps funds locally. The banks compete for funds, for bidding, for public deposits, and through this program, they're allowed to expand the FDIC insurance. Right now, $1.7 billion have stayed in Michigan of public funds, or Minnesota. I'm going to Michigan tomorrow, staying in Minnesota and public funds. So this is very important. If the funds are raised locally, this allows the banks to compete, price it, and keep the money locally so it can be put out in loans and economic development. All of this is done through the longstanding framework of the FDIC, so this is all based on current FDIC standards and the bank paying the assessment to the FDIC.
Thank you. Did you have any other witnesses?
I do not. The committee has questions of Mr. Davis or myself. Representative Hancock, I do believe, also has an amendment that he'd like to offer. I would look at that as a friendly amendment.
Okay. Representative Hancock, I see an A2 and A3 amendment. I understand that the A2 amendment has some drafting errors that just reflect the line numbers. Is that your understanding?
Madam Chair, that's my understanding, and I would like to move the A3 amendment.
Okay. We'll move the A3. Representative Hancock moves the A3 amendment, and the A2 amendment will be set aside. To your amendment, Representative Hancock. Could you explain it a little?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Basically, what this does is it extends the same basic concerns to the credit unions.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Madam Chair, I'll just speak to the matter a little bit more. When we drafted this language, banks do participate in the FDIC insurance. Because of the very nature and structure of credit unions, they're exempt from FDIC insurance, but they have a separate insurance for credit unions. The bill did not call for that. And I'm open to the amendment on here to allow the extension of this to credit unions as well in the state of Minnesota.
Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative O'Driscoll, I know this went through Commerce. We didn't have this discussion there, but I'm wondering, the insurance that the credit unions do have, is that comparable? Are the limits the same as far as the FDIC insurance goes?
Representative O'Driscoll?
Madam Chair, we do have present with us some members from the Credit Union Association. I'd like to have them perhaps come down and speak to their specific issues on this as they were interested in, if you will, the amendment that goes on to this to extend it to their members as well.
Good idea. Welcome to the committee, and if you could just identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Mara Humphrey with the Minnesota Credit Union Network. To that point, we do have similar, it's equivalent assurance. So it's up to $250,000 as well. It's basically the FDIC equivalent is the National Credit Union Share Insurance Fund.
Great.
Representative Sanders?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Ms. Humphreys. Do you guys currently, I understand that a lot of this is being driven from like school districts depositing money with the banks and wanting to be able to reinvest that back in the community, have access to that. Do you guys currently receive those sorts of deposits from school districts or other entities like that that are looking at doing this sort of thing? What I'm asking, do you have customers that are that this would be applicable to?
Ms. Humphrey?
Madam Chair, Ms. Representative Sanders, yes, we do. We currently do have credit unions who accept public deposits from local municipalities, school districts, county, cities, as well as state public deposits, and we wanted to just add this in so we would also have parity in law to be able to offer this type of product.
Representative Sanders.
And then, Madam Chair, and thank you, Ms. Humphreys, that helps too. And then, do you guys have a comparable product then to move the money back and forth across various institutions?
Ms. Humphrey?
Madam Chair, Representative Sanders, there are products that you can apply to and participate in, is my understanding, for credit unions. Yeah.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Anyone else that wanted to testify to the A3 amendment? Any further questions? Okay. Representative Hancock renews his motion. to amend House File 2174 with the A3 amendment. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Back to your bill, Representative O'Driscoll.
Madam Chair, I would just raise a couple of other housekeeping details. This bill did go through the Commerce Committee last week, and one of the questions that the Commerce Committee had, and I want to thank Representative Sanders as the Vice Chair of Commerce for, in essence, advocating for commerce-type questions on this. They were okay. We did discuss the credit unions going on, and I think some of the questions that Representative Sanders brought up, they were the questions that the committee members would have had either publicly or privately. And also not present with us today, but I did have a side conversation, and you can take me at my word, but Representative Nelson sits on the Commerce Committee as well, and I asked him if he had any questions with credit unions, and he had indicated that he would be fine with it as well. And I did make a commitment to Representative Atkins that if there was any questions on behalf of the Government Operations Committee, that we would re-refer back to Commerce. And at this point, I would ask if there are any questions of myself or the process, and if not, I would ask my motion be renewed the general register as amended.
Representative Sanders?
Madam Chair, without speaking completely for the chair of the Commerce Committee, but as the vice chair, I think that the amendment here does satisfy everything. I don't believe that it would need to go back to the Commerce Committee, and the original motion could stand.
Thank you. Any additional questions? Okay, Representative O'Driscoll has renewed his motion that House File 2174 be recommended to pass as amended and be placed on the general register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion does prevail. We are now on our
thank you.
Our last bill, 2169. As you will recall, we laid that over on Tuesday. If you could renew your motion, Representative Beard.
Madam Chair, I'd like to renew my motion that House Bill 2169 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the State Government Finance Committee. I believe that's the next stop. And Madam Chair and members, I do have a DE amendment that's important to the as this bill progresses. Madam Chair, when you're ready, I'd like to move the DE1 amendment to House Bill 2169. Explain how we got to it.
Representative Beard, I just wanted to acknowledge that this DE1 amendment did come in late, but we checked with Representative Nelson, and I believe that he was okay with missing the deadline. Does anyone else have a problem with us taking this up, even though that we missed our deadline? Okay. Seems like we have no problem, so would you like to go ahead and pass the amendment, or do you want to discuss the amendment first?
Madam Chair, I think it's fair because of the lateness and because it does do some changes that I think some members will be pleased with. I think we should explain it first. I think that would be good for the legislative process. So, Madam Chair, first of all, when the bill was here on Tuesday, I believe, there was some very good committee work being done, good questions being asked, and a couple comments that were made. And to me, as a legislator, I think most of the folks know that my door is always open and I'm interested in hearing the other points of view. And so taking some of those things into account, we amended the bill with this DE amendment to hopefully keep it the components I'm most interested in, which is engaging and reaffirming the legislator's responsibility and culpability with rulemaking as much as the agencies. I know there tends to be a tendency for us to look at the agencies and point the finger, but this actually asserts that the legislature is equally responsible for the rules that we have for the citizens of this state. So we amended the bill in ways that I thought I heard people discussing, and it would probably be best, Madam Chair, since Mr. Shepherd was so kind as to draft the amendment for me, to have him explain the essence of where the changes are. Mostly they are subtractions from the original bill, nothing really, I believe, that's new additions. But if I may ask Mr. Shepherd to go through it, that would probably be best.
Mr. Shepherd?
Madam Chair and members, first of all, the amendment incorporates the A1 amendment that the committee adopted 2 years ago, or 2 days ago.
Yeah. Seems like two years ago.
probably the most significant part of the delete everything amendment is at the very end. The original bill provided that rules of the PCA, DNR, Bowser, Environmental Quality Board, and the Department of Agriculture were repealed on August 1st, 2013, and this amendment does not contain that. So there is no longer a sunset of those rules. The other, there's a number of other changes, Madam Chair and members, that follow through the bill. And if you look on the amendment, page 1, lines 11 to 14, this is the section that deals with the authority of the Legislative Coordinating Commission or the House or Senate Governmental Operations Committees to object to a rule. And on page 1, lines 11 to 14 has the grounds for objection now, which are different and fewer than the grounds for objection in the original bill. In the amendment, the grounds for objection are as stated there on lines 11 to 14. The original bill had a number of additional grounds for objection. That theme carries through to the role of the Sunset Advisory Commission. One of the parts of the original bill was to add some additional things that the Sunset Advisory Commission would consider relating to rules when it was reviewing an agency. And the original bill had some different standards for the Sunset Commission to consider. And now on the top of page 3 of the amendment are the new standards that the Sunset Commission would consider. And finally, that continues, Madam Chair, some of the changes to the Sunset Commission through page 5. And I believe the other significant thing I wanted to highlight in the amendment that's different from the bill is on page 7 of the amendment relating to the Statement of Need and Reasonableness, sometimes known as a SONAR, that agencies issue when they are proposing rules. This changes the language from the original bill. The original bill had some language about whether the rule has a substantial economic impact. That is gone, and the new language you see on page 7, lines 7, 8, and 8, and 12, and 13. Madam Chair, on the last section of the bill, there continues to be a review of certain rules on section 10, page 8. The criteria for that review are changed from the original bill in line with some of the earlier language about the duties of the Sunset Commission with respect to rules. And as I mentioned at the outset, the sunset of all of the rules of the stated agencies is no longer in this amendment.
Madam Chair, thank you. And thank you, Mr. Shepherd, for explaining the amendment.
Representative Simon.
Thank you. Representative Beard, I have a question that probably should have come up in the original hearing. Maybe you or Ms. Burnett can answer it. In terms of just the history here, it's really a history question.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking at page 1 of the DE amendment, and it says that right now any committee with primary jurisdiction mm-hmm. can already object to a current rule, not a proposed rule. That's yeah. You're proposing that it be a proposed rule. I can't remember a time, at least personally, on any committee I've served at in the 7 years I've been here where a committee has taken a stand against a rule. Am I wrong about that? Maybe it's just the committees I serve on. I've never seen that. Do you know anything? Can you tell us a little bit more, or can anyone, about the history? It seems like a little used power that we have in the legislature here to say any committee, the Agriculture Committee, the Environment Committee, can right now say, as to a already implemented rule, not a proposed rule, can already take a stand, essentially. Can anyone, I wish Representative Kahn was here, or someone who has, you know, a generation or two of experience. I'm just curious about that. It's one of those powers that that we don't, that seems little used, and I'm wondering if someone can explain.
Representative Beard?
Madam Chair, thank you, Representative Simon, for the question. Indeed, the power to object to existing rules does exist. It's one that I think the average legislator is not aware of. And part of the purpose of the bill, as I stated in my opening comments, is that to reassert and reaffirm and just shine the light on all of the legislators who are going to be hearing this discussion, and there'll be a few committee stops where we'll have this chat, that indeed that already exists within the legislature for existing rules. There is some tweaking because we are now, if the bill becomes law, it will assert that proposed rules will also be presented to not only the standing committees and the ranking minority members as well, but to the Legislative Coordinating Commission. And it kind of underscores and punctuates the concept, not the concept, the reality, that when we in the legislature complain about, or citizens complain to us about the rules that the agencies are making, we are as responsible as they are. It kind of underscores and punctuates that point, Representative Simon. I wish Representative Seifert was here as well, because I remember serving on this committee when Representative Kahn and Representative Seifert would go at it over the rulemaking process, and both of them were kind of experts on this. I'm sort of getting a fire hose approach to this over the last couple of weeks as we've taken this on again, because there is a lot to learn about the rulemaking process and the responsibilities we as legislators have. This merely kind of underscores, punctuates, and adds a few more concepts to that rulemaking process.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Beard. I find it really, truly interesting. There are other powers. For example, a power that I've never seen used since I've been here is that committees actually have subpoena power. It's little used in part because the threshold is really high. I think it's something like I should know my rules better, but it's a very high threshold. It's not just a majority vote. Mm-hmm. But if some supermajority of the committee votes,
yes,
we actually have congressional-like subpoena power, where under some considerable penalty, we can compel testimony here. That's pretty extraordinary. I mean, there are all sorts of powers that, and I don't mean to devolve here into a seminar on legislative rules, but I find it interesting that we already have a lot of tools to do a lot of the oversight work that legislatures should do. But back to rulemaking here, what's interesting to me about the legislative power that we already have as to currently implemented rules is we can choose, essentially, regardless of this statute, we can choose to override or eliminate any rule that we want right now. And it is worth noting that we're the ones who, if everything goes correctly, we're the ones who explicitly authorize rules. And so, in a sense, we might not like the way that rules are worded or how they're implemented or how they're authorized, but we collectively as a legislature have only ourselves to blame in some sense for rules. Now, I'm not saying there aren't instances where there's duplication and needless detail or an agency that once or twice or more than once and twice will go beyond what we believe that we explicitly delegated. But I guess the point I'm trying to make is that, you know, the buck really does stop with the legislature here. I think we already have a lot of tools in the toolbox, to use the shop horn cliche, to get at rules that we don't like of any kind. It's not a comment for or against your bill, but I'm wondering, how do you see this? How do you see this kind of being interwoven with the powers that we already have? Apart from the obvious that this now extends to proposed rules, that part I get.
Representative Beard,
Madam Chair, Representative Simon, and members, you're reminding me of a project I have in my shop. Speaking of tools in the toolbox, my shop at home, where I inherited from one of my great uncles a box of tools that came with a tractor. I somehow seem to have picked up along the way. And you get those out, and you scratch off the rust, and you shine them up, and you sharpen them, and figure out, hey, these still work today, or, boy, this is going on the antique shelf because it doesn't make any sense anymore. And I think those are some of the things that we have. As legislators, Representative Simon, I think you and I have been here 10 years now, and it constantly amazes me the things I trip over that we do not use. They're in that toolbox we inherited from those who came before us. And I think this is one of those exercises in wire brushing them and rubbing them with WD-40 and realizing, hey, we do have this authority and we can use it for good, as we see, and bring these things up for discussion. The proposed new rules, I think that is a one thing we should bring up, because as you're speaking, I'm recalling on the Transportation Committee where I sit, there are a couple of bills that I've thrown in the hopper regarding seat belts, window tinting, gas cans on trailers, and farmers hauling grain to market. And as I call the State Patrol in and say, what the hay is happening here, they hold up a little sheet that was half a page long with a bill that we voted on a couple years ago, and it just says, we will hereby comply with U.S. Code Title whatever. That was it. And we voted for those things, and I had absolutely no idea that was happening. And they were federal rules that were being promulgated, and we were coming into compliance with, and my bad for not getting out the book and reading what we were voting on. But I think it underscores the point that we have to make the agencies, including one of my favorite agencies, DOT, come over from time to time, Department of Public Safety, and explain to us what they're doing and why they're doing it. In some cases, we may not have the authority, but at least we will understand what is being done to us and what's happening under on our watch. And for that reason, I'm grateful that I've had good help from Lisa and Lloyd and others in putting this bill together that kind of, again, underscores and builds on existing law, existing statute, that we are as responsible as the agencies for the rules we have to deal with.
Thank you. Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And I have to applaud you, Representative Beard. This bill has come a long way, a very long way, and you've worked very hard. And I really appreciate that. I had asked a question on Tuesday, and maybe you can answer it, maybe you can't. When we talk about existing rules and proposed rules, how many rules are we talking about? Now, I mean, existing, there might be thousands. So when you're changing this, now you're not so much, you're not so much sunsetting the existing rules, which that's what I understand. Yep. But how many proposed rules are there a year, and what will that add to the workload of the various parties involved?
Representative Beard.
Madam Chair, Representative Scalzi, I actually have that written right down here in my notes because I've had one of my interns working on that, an answer to that question, and in the last 48 or 72 hours, here's what we found. One agency actually called, that would be DNR, and said, basically, I know I'm paraphrasing, are you kidding? They sent me the executive overview from 2003. There are 45 chapters of rules in DNR. Each one of these has hundreds, if not thousands, of rules in each chapter. And that's just DNR. The Ag Department said, boy, I don't know where we could find that for you. DOT said, well, what rules do you want? And, I mean, we got a host of answers. And I'm not disparaging the agencies because it is a very large ask. It's one reason I felt comfortable amending out the sunset on all the rules in August 1st of 2013. That mountain isn't only too tall to climb. It's like a vertical face with no handholds. It's so big. So we decided to let the... If you look at the Sunset Commission's review responsibility, it's staged by agency over the next 8 years. And that seemed prudent to allow that staging because it is a very big ask, Representative. Thank you for asking the questions. But I had a couple of the staff guys running around like crazy trying to actually get a concrete answer. And all I can tell you is the one I got my hands on was from DNR. They sent me the executive summary of 45 chapters, which numbers into the thousands of rules. So. And that's as close as I can get to answering the question accurately.
Representative Scalzi.
So I'm glad to be of help, so thank you. I guess I stirred a hornet's nest. And
oh, yeah.
I think that shows how far-reaching it had been and how not far-reaching it is in the current delete all amendment. So I'm just then questioning how many proposed rules, and maybe the DNR would have that answer. How many changes would come each year that we would have to add to the workload of the various commissions?
Representative Scalzi, we do have several people that wanted to talk about this, including Mr. Meyer from the DNR. So yes, if you could hold off on that question, maybe this would be a good time to have the folks who requested to testify. Mm-hmm. And if you could, we do have several people that have requested to testify, so if you could just... hold up a little bit. I have a list. Why don't we take, we can take Mr. Meyer since that was one of the questions. And then after that we'll do Ms. Gaithier, Greta Gaithier, or unless there's a certain order you'd like.
Madam Chair, members of the record, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. For the sake of time, I know we have plenty of time, but you might want to have more time for lunch occasionally or not. We thought we'd come up as a group and just talk about our concerns. Seeing the amendment for the first time this morning, it has changed our comments somewhat. I'll get to Representative Scalzi's question when I make my remarks, but we'd just like to talk about Greta's group from Department of Agriculture, talk about overall some of the impacts, first of all.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Greta Gaithier. I'm at the Department of Agriculture, and thank you for giving us a chance to testify today on House File 2169. Looking at the delete all, which the agency saw this morning, I would have to say overall, first, thank you to Representative Beard and his staff for removing the sunset of the five agencies' rules at the end of this biennium. that is a significant change to the bill, and we appreciate seeing that. That would have been a big heartburn for us. So we appreciate that that section has been removed. There are other changes here as your council went over. This portion of the statute that you're amending, part of it deals with all the five agencies listed at the end, but other parts of this bill are dealing with all agencies. And so we would like to have a chance to vet this with other agencies. I would like to point out, though, that there are some general comments that we can give you at this point in time. Chapter 3, 305 sub 8 deals with the LCC, current law, and it says that at any time two members of the LCC or five members of the legislature can request that a rule be reviewed, and then once that hurdle is five members make that request, then the LCC shall review a state agency rule. So just to point out that there is a fairly clear and process in place already by which only five members or two members of the LCC have to request a rule in order for it to be pulled into the LCC. With that, I would say that there's some concern about the addition of proposed rules and not having clarity yet. Again, not having seen this amendment till this morning, wondering at what point that would occur and how that would impact, how that would fall into line with the public testimony or public input portion of rulemaking, or when the ALJ is looking at rules and how that all will fit together for the various agencies is not something that I'm able to give you anything concrete on at this time. We would need to go back and look through and talk to the people in the agencies and staff and that sort of thing. We just wanted to go on record, though, as saying that we do see some general problems here, and the proposed rule is one of them. Definition of some of the other terms is a difficult, page 7, line 12, reasonable particularity. We don't know what does that mean, where is that defined in statute. And then section 10, the report is still there, and there is a later deadline from the same as the delete all you adopted on Tuesday. But nevertheless, there's still information in the report that is not something that the agency already is compiling for the SONAR process, the Statement of Need and Reasonableness, that would require additional work. Plus, that is required, that report, for each rule, as you look on 824. So, for the Department of Agriculture, we have 22 chapters of active rule, but that's about 600 pages of paper that is like the state register, tiny print. But it covers everything from food safety to exports to invasive species to lots of other things. I need to go back and, for my own agency, talk to staff and figure out what this would mean in terms of the amount of work necessary to compile this much information. And I think with that, I understand this will be going to other committees, and we'll have a chance to weigh in at that time. And we're happy to work with the author on this bill. But at this time, I'll turn it over to my counterparts from two agencies anyway, Pollution Control and DNR, who are also here today. And we can give you some initial feedback based in addition to what I've already said, Madam Chair. And then I think we'd be happy to try to answer questions as we can.
Okay. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Chair and committee members, my name is Kirk Adelka. I'm the Legislative Director for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. I just wanted to reiterate a little bit about the current tools available to the legislature and give some examples of how it's been used in the past successfully, and to illustrate our belief that there are avenues already available that work, and maybe they just need to be used more often. Department of Ag mentioned already that LCC has the ability to bring in a rule for discussion and a hearing, And the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency is one such agency that that opportunity was afforded. In 2004, we were looking at making some changes dealing with transfer stations for solid waste, demolition landfills, and some beneficial use determinations and research projects. We went before the LCC at that point, and all the stakeholders were allowed early in the process to discuss their concerns when we're still looking at the scope of the rulemaking. And because of that hearing, we decided we were doing too much at that time. We scaled back our rulemaking. Only half of it went forward, and the other half we decided not to. By early involvement, it instead of coming at the back end of rulemaking, it saved time and resources for everyone involved, agencies and stakeholders. Coming at the end of the process, with the legislature being involved, and then giving a thumbs up or down on the rules just negates all the work being done before. Early participation can have much better effect on a rule and save everyone time. And given the current process already, MPCA is out meeting with various groups to make improvements on how we handle rulemaking now to get at some of these things using the current system in place. For instance, we met with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, its members, local units of governments, and environmental groups over the last several months, our assistant commissioner and rulemaking staff, on finding ways to improve the process and ensure folks' thoughts are considered early on in the process and their ability to improve the rulemaking if enhanced. And so we are making our own changes internally using the current structure by retooling the way we use the formal request for comment that kicks off the rulemaking process, and improving an explanation of our intended scope of the rulemaking, what type of things we're looking for input to help make that decision whether early on, before all the resources and time is committed by everyone, whether we should move forward on various parts. Also sharing draft rule language prior to the formal comment periods and a few other changes to help make the process more efficient using the current system in place already.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you very much, and thank you, Representative Beard, for the work that you've done on this bill to date. One of our main concerns at the department, I'm sorry, Bob Meyer with the DNR, thank you very much. One of our concerns with the department was having to come back and discuss within the legislature possibility of ginseng rules or fish and wildlife stamp design contests, all the number of our rules that we do have. And I did hand out two pieces of paper at the last committee. One was a list that I believe should be in your packet of all the rules that we have from the 2003 report that Representative Beard spoke of, and also a copy of a bill that was signed into law in 2000, Chapter 469, which really began the process that I think Representative Beard is looking at right now. That bill, it actually amended or created 14.3691, which required rule review and legislative oversight by the departments. And it may be in your packet still. It says session law on here. It was distributed before we were able to testify.
I believe it's being passed out.
Okay, great. Thank you. I apologize. Part of that, and this is it's on page 4, the language I'm talking about here, the agencies had to prepare a report looking at their rules, and the report must, I'm just reading from this document here, list any rules that the entity recommends or repeal, list and briefly describe the rationale for rules that the entity believes should remain in effect, and suggest any changes in rules that would improve the agency's ability to meet the regulatory objectives prescribed by the legislature while reducing any unnecessary burdens on regulated parties. I did not bring that report here today. Representative Beard has a copy. I can send the committee a link to that, or I could PDF it if you'd like to see that. But really, it's the kind of thing that they're asking for in Section 10. For our agency, it's been done. Most other agencies have it as well. But we're concerned about the deadline of January 15th, 2013, and the fiscal impacts it may cause, because there's no funding for this. We'll have to shift staff around to get this done, and what may or may not get done because of that. So that's one of the concerns we still need to work on. Another thing that I think Mr. Kadelka brought up is the public participation process in the rulemaking activities that are out there right now. One of the barriers, Madam Chair, I hope you would look at is Chapter 14.1285, which only provides for an 18-month period to get a rule done. Otherwise, you lose that rulemaking authority. This is a huge barrier in the administration trying to provide a public, transparent, and open rulemaking process, because to do it the right way on some of these controversial rules, we need more than 18 months. So while that's not the subject of the bill today, Madam Chair, I hope that at some point in time we can talk about that piece of law, because that has caught ourselves and other agencies up in that time frame. And just, I know Representative Scalzi has been waiting on pins and needles for the answer to her questions, but we did have an issue where the legislature kind of stepped in on one of our rulemakings, and it dealt with aquatic plant management, particularly the operation of the program and the fees. The legislature passed a law that said we had to, the rule couldn't go into effect until 45 days after it was presented to the legislature. We ran into some timing issues. It was delayed by a year. The rule has since been tied up in other statutes, but the bottom line is the general fund continues to subsidize the issuance and operations of aquatic plant management permits for people who are removing plants from their shoreline. So in that instance, we were trying to have the program fully pay for its costs, and now we're still subsidizing it with general fund dollars. So I understand the yin and the yang of legislative review and approval, and we're very, very committed to an open and transparent process, making sure people understand what we're doing and that we are working within our boundaries. But we do need to work on this bill as it moves forward, and we still have some concerns with it.
Representative Erdahl, you had a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and you can answer this individually, collectively, or however you wish. Do you have timelines for bill creation, or do you just do them as they come up? You see a need and you begin the rulemaking.
Mr. Kudelka.
Chair and committee members, at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, we have a lot of our rulemaking is dependent on the federal government and our delegated programs. And when the federal government makes changes, we many times have to fill in the blanks on some of that those issues. So rulemakings for a section of ours are dependent on the federal government. We have an internal policy where rulemaking processes come up through our medium forms, air, land, and water, and go up through senior management to determine whether things are at the right time for them. So we do have some process there to kind of keep the docket moving. Our agency currently has 13 ongoing rulemakings at this time. So we do, because of the large amount and small amount of resources we have for it, we do have to create a timeline. We do have things in the queue coming up. We have, for instance, the chamber has expressed interest in a number of rulemakings that are in the docket. Next up, once we free up resources, we do have a list of dockets.
Madam Chair, if I may, at the Department of Agriculture, a lot of the time we are, we also have federal rules, rules that we initiate and instigate because of changes in federal requirements, because we are the delegate of the Food and Drug Administration in Minnesota. But additionally, we will change rules when the ag community comes to us and says, you know, there's something we need to work on, there's a problem we want to solve, can we change this? We are responsive to the ag community and try to work with them as much as possible. One example of that is in a small kind of housekeeping policy and tech bill that will be coming through, which I believe, Representative Erdahl, you're a co-author on.
But what one?
I think it's 2398.
It's a great bill.
Yes, thank you, Representative Erdahl, Madam Chair. We're changing the rules pertaining to our grain permits and grain licensure. And changing that system to both reflect the way the industry has changed, and that's just one example. We also change rules to reflect, to comply with new requirements from the European Union or other international certification organizations so that our exports from Minnesota can continue on. So we change rules in response to what's happening in the global ag marketplace, what's happening with ag stakeholders in Minnesota, and that sort of thing, as well as when the federal government comes down and says, we're changing the law, so you now have to change your rules as well.
Madam Chair, just real quickly, the DNR does have some federal requirements we need to have our rules update with, but all of our rulemaking, and I think it's fair to say all of the executive branch's rulemaking, is explicitly authorized by statute. The legislature has given us that authority. So it's not like we're just deciding to do rules on one thing or another. This has been coming through through committees and bills signed into law with the legislature's consent and advice. And just one other comment on the bill. We would rather, and I've talked about this on other bills as well, as an executive branch, talk about the rules that people have problems with, that are impeding commerce or that do have issues, and spend our time working productively on changing, amending, or repealing those rules rather than writing reports to justify all the rules we have. So hopefully we can work and get to that point as well.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the rules can be changed and come up at any time. The question is then how is the public alerted when rules are changed or new rules are brought?
Mr. Kadalka.
Chair and committee members, the PCA and I believe most agencies have a rule docket on their website. The Administrative Procedure Act has a number of times where we have to go out and put out times publicly, put in the state registry when we're looking to start a rulemaking, put a request in for comments on what the scope will be. As we continue to work with stakeholders, our agency puts out information, public hearings and meetings with stakeholders who are interested to provide feedback. When we get an actual draft of the rules, there's a requirement that again goes in the state registry and at least a 30-day public comment period. There's chances for contested case hearings and other avenues. And then finally, the rule needs to also go in before the state registry again when it's intended to be adopted in its final format. So there's a number of public requirements we have to do, and agencies on our own also increase that by having additional meetings with stakeholders or interested parties and rules to make sure that they do have some feedback into the process.
Madam Chair, if I may, Representative Erdahl, I would have to get back to you to check for all the different divisions of agriculture because we do both regulation and promotion in agriculture. But I will say for the specific grain rules that are in the bill that you're co-authoring, and thank you for that, Representative Erdahl. You know, we were in discussion with the Grain and Feed Association, the wheat growers, the corn growers, the soybean growers, et cetera, as we worked to find a way to make it better. We came up with an idea, vetted it with them, came back and forth, back and forth. So I think that we also have website access to that information. The rules that we are federally required to do through the Food and Drug Administration or the EPA, there are standard ways that individuals and businesses can find out about those as well. But I will give you more detail. Thank you.
Thanks, Madam Chair, at the DNR we utilize a lot of those techniques, listservs, email lists, public comment hearings, public meetings. We hold meetings throughout the state on a regular basis, especially on our game and fish rules and proposed rules. So we also have an extensive list of email notifications you can get. You can sign up off our website to get all of our news releases, for example, anything related to rulemaking or legislative activities. So it's really easy to do a good job at public notification these days with all the information and communication tools we have, and we take that very seriously.
Representative Simon, and perhaps when we ask questions, it might be more efficient if we just have one of the three answer, unless they're very different responses.
Madam Chair, I can wait. My questions were for the proponents of the bill, not the testifier.
Okay. Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And as I'm listening to this, I'm thinking just because I was a part of, you know, the Lakes Associations that were working on the aquatic plant management, and it took years and still hasn't really been solved as from what I understand. And I, as a state representative, I get the phone calls right away. I hadn't known about it, but I got the phone calls right away from both sides. And that, I mean, in Minnesota with 15,000 lakes, we hear from people who have an issue or an interest and they see something on the DNR website. And I think that maybe we're talking more about communication because from what I heard when this bill was first presented is that the problem is that a state legislator hears from a constituent that says, what are you guys doing down there? Because now this rule is here and then we don't know about it. And so I'm not sure how this is going to work because I see the word report and I know that's going to be a lot of work. and it's going to cost us money. And I'm just wondering if there isn't an easier way to do this short of all of us just reading the register constantly, because I just don't have time to do that until somebody calls me and asks me about it. It's very difficult for us because we're the ones answering to the public if something happens that they don't like. That's what I see here as the communication problem. And I'm wondering if there isn't a better way to do this other than waiting until the end when the public has done all their working and communicating, and then there's a rule and then there's a report. Boy, I'd hate to tell all those people that their work was not worth anything. That might be 2-3 years worth of work. I think it's a disservice to the public, and I don't know how best to do it. I wish I had an answer for my question, because I think there must be a better way to do this, to let legislators know what's in the pipeline before it comes to the head where the work has already been done. And maybe Representative Beard knows that, maybe Lisa Frenette knows that, but I don't know it, and there's got to be a better way to do this.
Yeah, I appreciate your comment. I don't know that anybody can answer that question right here. I think is Mr. Jasky coming today?
Madam Chair, I'm sorry Mr. Jasky got pulled away. He was not able to attend.
Okay, I do have one other person that wanted to testify on the list. If it's okay, if we're done with these witnesses, we can...
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yep. Mr. Morse?
Madam Chair, I think Mr. Lincheski might be interested also. Maybe he could join me at the same time. We could do a little panel.
Yep, that would be fine, and just identify yourself before you begin.
Great, thank you. My name is Steve Morse. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Environmental Partnership. We're the state's largest coalition of environmental conservation groups with a combined membership of 450,000 Minnesotans. And I do have a handout I'd like to share with the committee if that's possible, if there's a way to get those distributed. Thank you very much. Madam Chair and members and Representative Beard, thank you for the changes that have been made to the bill since we were here just a couple of days ago. The provision that we considered most onerous, which was the wholesale repeal of the rules, I understand is now out of the bill as I'm just looking through the delete all amendment. And so thank you for that. I would still just make a couple of points. Number one, we recognize that the legislature has a very appropriate role in overseeing the rules and the rulemaking process that agencies engage in. But I would particularly ask you to be mindful of what the capacity of the legislature is and what the respective roles of the legislature and the executive are. One thing that I didn't say in my introduction that I should have is I know many of you, but not everybody, and my experience includes being in the state Senate for 12-plus years, as well as 4 years as deputy commissioner of the State Department of Natural Resources. So I've looked at this rule issue from a couple of different perspectives. And although it's not perfect, I think we are striking a good balance with what we currently have in law, where the agencies are forced to review their rules periodically, come forward with those that are outdated, are duplicative, or no longer necessary. What we would suggest is that we leave that system alone and allow it to work and oversee it and encourage it to work. I would also point out that Minnesotans, well, two other things. This bill still unfairly targets the environment-related agencies, DNR, PCA, EQB, Department of Ag, who am I missing there? PCA, I think, the five agencies. Board of Water and Soil Resources. And although it doesn't do a wholesale repeal of the rules, what it creates is a tremendously increased workload for agencies that took a disproportionate cut in last year's budget round. Remember, our environmental agencies took about, I believe the figure was about double the general fund cut of other parts of state government. And so we have agencies that are increasingly stressed with less and less time and resources, and they have work to do, very important work, and I think we share a common goal that we'd like them to accomplish their work in a timely and effective manner. Mm-hmm. And this is going the other direction, is it'll increase their time doing reporting and re-justifying what they've already justified in the formal process. And the last point I'd like to make is just share with you some recent polling we just did last month. We did two extensive polls of Minnesotans in the last month, to find out where Minnesotans are. And if you turn to the back of this, is the question I want to address. is after going through last year's legislative session and having 40 bills that were in play that were rolling back environmental protections, we asked the public, without biasing them, we use a bipartisan national polling team of a Republican firm and a Democratic firm who develop our questions, do the polling, and do the analysis afterwards. We asked Minnesotans, what do you think about environmental protections? Would you like to see them be made tougher? Would you like to see the law stay the same but just do better enforcement, which could be read as more effective rules? And 67%, two-thirds of the public said yes, tougher or better enforcement. Another 19% leave well enough alone. Only 12% of the public says that we should weaken or roll back our environmental protections. And although this bill is backed off somewhat, we still view it as a rollback and a weakening of environmental protections because it diverts precious resources that we have within our agencies who are trying to do their job. And I would note that we gave you the party demographic breakouts also, and across every political party, Democrat, Republican, and independent, if you call, I guess that would be a party yet, a majority of Minnesotans want tougher enforcement or tougher laws. And even amongst Republicans, a full 75% of the people surveyed say, leave well enough alone or make it tougher, but don't roll it back. And so, members of the committee, we would ask you to thank you for your work so far on this, but we still think it's an unnecessary bill in the way that it targets our environmental agencies and will distract from their effective work. Thank you for the time.
Thank you. If you could identify yourself for the tape as well.
Yes, my name is John Lincheski. I'm with Minnesota Trout Unlimited. And here to offer some perspective as one who's participated in the rulemaking process, and we are also the regulated. We do a lot of stream habitat work, and so we have to comply with rules. I will say that the rulemaking process is extremely thorough and quite impressive that the agencies follow. Has all the stakeholders involved. It's a very lengthy process, much more time devoted than the legislative committee could afford to do, and that's, I think, why that responsibility is delegated to the agencies. But it's extremely thorough, all the stakeholders involved, and, you know, it's reviewed by an administrative law judge, typically. I mean, these are very well thought out, well looked at rules, and you know, I think the result you know, has to stand up to scrutiny, including that it's been authorized by the legislature. So it's a very good process, and you know, we are opposed to this bill. We think it would just create an extra layer of work on top of all that work that was done, and we do appreciate the improvements in this amendment, but I think if you look at the language, the agencies will still have a huge burden. I mean, they've got to try and go, and specifically in Section 10, where the agency will have to, you know, look at, you know, analyze other chain circumstances, what's the cumulative effect, not just looking at other state rules, but federal rules, local ordinances. I mean, this is just a huge kind of a make-work burden here. I think it'd be better to focus on what specific rules has the legislature identified that might be problematic. But this will be a huge burden for the agency, and it's at a time when, say, particularly the DNR and fisheries management, they're very short on dollars. And I serve on the Citizens Budgetary Oversight Committee, can assure you that there is no fat left in the DNR and that they are in very hard times, and fisheries programs to improve and maintain our fisheries are suffering right now. And they're going to have to divert more resources to try and comply with this legislation. So we're opposed to the rule despite its improvement. We think it'd be better to focus energy on an identified problem rather than sort of a fishing expedition of going through all these huge volume of rules, which, you know, arrived at using good sound science, and that's part of what the department does. So thank you.
Thank you. We do have one question, and then we do have one more witness that wanted to testify. So Representative Simon.
Thank you. I'll try to be quick. Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, this bill has gotten a lot better to my mind, and I'm warming to a lot of it. And you know, the part that I like the best on line 7.7, 7.8 of the DE is this idea that as part of the SONAR process, statement of need and reasonableness, you have to talk about the cumulative effect of the rule with other federal state regulations. So what I wanted to ask you And one of the points that I think Representative Beard and the proponents have been making is, how do you respond generally, and maybe this is for Mr. Morse, given his experience, how do you respond generally to the allegation or the idea that there's duplication among some of the agencies that you mentioned, that we have a lot of people regulating water quality, for example, and that maybe the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing? That line seems addressed to that concern, which at least theoretically seems like a legitimate concern to me. How do you address that? Maybe that's impossibly broad for the time we have here, but what about the general idea that there may be some duplication there, that agencies are doing really good and thorough and honest work, and they absolutely mean well, and they're doing what they believe the law tells them they ought to be doing, but nonetheless, a lot of that's going on across different agencies. What do you make of that?
Mr. Morris?
Madam Chair, Representative Simon, you know, I wish I could have heard the agency testimony to that, because I would be curious as to how they would approach that. I mean, I think it's a valid question. Whether it belongs in the rulemaking process, I'd want to look a little bit more about how they would assess it and how burdensome it would be in order to do that. Part of that responsibility, of course, is here in the legislature for how the agencies are structured. I would want to learn more, quite frankly. I mean, could there potentially be overlap in some areas? Yes. And the other thing I'd say is that, you know, what I don't see enough of is what happens if we, you know, what are the benefits of the rules? And so there's the overlap, but it's also what's the benefit that we get from them, and what happens if we don't do it.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Morris, thank you for being with us today. Just want to follow up a little bit on a statement that you had made, talking about funding reductions and cuts and the like. Are you aware of any money that would go from the 3/8 cent constitutional amendment to any of the agencies that you're speaking of that would help shore up activities that you're speaking about today?
Mr. Morris?
Madam Chair, I think most of the agencies, except for maybe EQB, get some money out of the legacy amendment. The legacy amendment was passed to go beyond what we were doing when it was passed in 2008. And we're actually just looking at these numbers this morning. The percentage of money that the state is investing in environment and natural resources has fallen from about 1% to 0.75% in the last budget. And so our argument would be that we are not keeping faith, and yes, there's money going into some of those agencies, but at the same time we're reducing the traditional level of efforts. And so it was never intended to substitute, and it says that in the Constitution. I don't know if that gets to your question.
Representative O'Driscoll, and I think Representative Riddle might want to comment that as the chair of the Legacy Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That was one of the things I was going to say is I'm under the understanding that in a biennium there's over $500 million or $500 million, however you want to quantify that, that goes to the causes that you're speaking about. And I was going to suggest we do have the chair of the Legacy Committee, and maybe he could shed some additional light on that for us.
Good idea. Representative Riddle.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, well, Representative Driscoll, first of all, $500 million goes into the, there's four different categories, so it's not all going to water or not all going to outdoor heritage. And also, you're correct, Representative O'Driscoll mentioned the shoring up. Well, that's not the intent of the money. It's supposed to go above and beyond what is currently being done. And it is a concern if things are being backfilled, if the traditional sources of funding are being cut down, because that's not the intent of the amendment, but it is now and will be probably for the next 22 years a subject of debate in the state over the words supplant and supplement. I mean, this is, as I say, a discussion we're having, and I don't see any end to it.
Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Beard, I want to thank you for the work that you've done thus far. I think this bill has gotten significantly better, is starting to hone in on what the issue is, and kind of piggybacking off of what Representative Simon says. Simon said in his question to you, Mr. Lenchowski and Mr. Morse, I think the issue is kind of understated by most of your testimony, which is saying that it's a huge burden for you guys to get back to us with what your own rules are. That's kind of a major problem that we're seeing here, and that we're trying to answer to our constituents when they come to us and ask us questions about all these rules. for the agencies to come back and tell us it's a huge burden for them to just deliver their own rules to the legislature, I think that that's a major problem that, that this bill is attempting to really hit at and really get at. So I want to thank Representative Beard for bringing this forward. I know that it still has a long way to go on the path. I know that the bill has had some movement and that you'll continue to work with those that are involved. But I want to thank you for moving this forward. It's a greatly important issue.
Thank you. And at this time, I'd like to get the final witness, and then we can hopefully get a vote in the near future here. So if you could keep your comments relatively brief, that'd be greatly appreciated.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Twyla Braze. I'm president of Citizens Council for Health Freedom. And I just wanted to thank Representative Beards as well for bringing it here. And just to say a few things, one, to say that we've been involved a lot in rulemaking, and just to sort of piggyback on Representative Scalzi, it's not only a problem for representatives to keep knowing what on earth is in that state register, but I can tell you for a fact that the public doesn't know that the state register exists, let alone to look at it, and it's a burden on our organization even to try and figure it out as well. I want to point you to the fact that some have said that in Congress, 9/10 of the laws are actually written by regulators, and which means that these are unelected folks making decisions that the public can comment on but really doesn't have control over. And so I'm very pleased with the idea that the legislature would like to take back under its wing a lot more authority over the rules that are written. I'd prefer less rules to be written and more law to be written so that these things were actually determined by people who are elected and by people who are representing the public rather than the officials in the agencies. So I'd also like to say, rather than maybe a little bit what Mr. Morris said, is I actually would prefer to have some more agencies added to that list who would have to provide that type of information, like the Health Department and the Department of Human Services and some others. So thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you. At this time, I'd like to welcome Representative Beard back to the table.
Madam Chair, members, thank you. That was great testimony. It's fascinating to sit and listen to the discussion and think about how it can make a good bill better, and in some cases how it actually, I think, makes the point that maybe I need to make better when I'm telling you why I think this bill is actually worthy of your consideration. Madam Chair, there were just a couple things that were talked about, not the least of which was the last testifiers that spoke about the five agencies where we were proposing to repeal the rules and actually force the legislature. That was the other part of the repeal. It wasn't just repeal. It was all the rules would be reaffirmed by a positive reaffirming vote of the legislature, and that was done very deliberately. But I'll admit it is a very large reach to do that. Part of the reason we were doing that is because of some of the questions I heard from Representative Simon about how do we uncover duplicative rules then? And one of them is to force the review. One of the complaints we hear as we're just being citizen legislators from around the state is why, when we deal with water, are there five agencies that deal with water? Water's water, and we want the water to be clean. Those are givens. But why do we force people to go to at least three agencies for stormwater? A testimony we just had in another committee that I chair. Reviewing these rules actually will force us to face up to how can we do this better? How can we still keep our standard high but have our citizens only comply with, say, one set of rules instead of three set of rules? Or heck, just give me two set of rules. That would be a huge step in the right direction. That is the intent of what we were trying to do. We did repeal that portion out, but we left the other portions in there on purpose so that we can still have clean tools that aren't quite so rusty in our toolbox. And we still have this awareness, and we are creating awareness, I think we'll all agree, among legislators, that we are as responsible as the agencies for the rules that we promulgate. Just a brief case in point, then I'm going to wrap to my conclusion. Red flashing lights on funeral processions. Did you know that public safety proposed rules to make those illegal? I don't believe the legislature ever asked for that, but we did get the notification. In this case, a legislator happened to notice. Oh, wait, there's a rulemaking coming from the department, and they're in the process. I tip my hat to public safety for making us aware, and we're able to engage in that discussion, because not all rulemaking comes from the legislature. A fair amount of it actually comes from the federal government, as we heard testimony. And I think as you read the bill, the proposal is that we will be notified of rulemaking that's driven by federal requirements, but that we will not stop rulemaking made by federal requirements. Federal law is federal law and preempts us in many cases. like it or lump it, that's the way it is. But at least we'll know about it. So as legislators, when we get calls, we'll be in the loop. I think that some of the things we're talking about with public notification are good. I applaud particularly MPCA. I know that it's one of the ones we love to beat up on, but Commissioner Osnes, I believe, has actually done an outstanding job of trying to repair the image and improve their image and working with the public as they're promulgating rules, most of which are driven by the federal government. I just am proposing this House Bill 2169 to make sure we're in the loop as well. The Legislative Coordinating Commission is new in the loop on this because members, and we should probably have a discussion again someday on the rulemaking process. I think Judge Lippman tried to do that with us here a few months ago. But the Legislative Coordinating Commission meets year-round, so they're faster on their feet and can respond more quickly than the chairs and ranking members can, because we're only here, what, 4 or 5 months a year? Yes, we're legislators year-round, but it's kind of difficult to call a committee meeting and have a hearing in the off-season. But the Legislative Coordinating Commission can meet much more quickly. Members, again, thank you for your attention to this bill, for the great questions, the great discussion, for adopting my amendment to the bill. In fact, we haven't adopted it yet, I don't believe, so we're still talking about that. But I'm happy to stand for any questions or entertain the vote, Madam Chair.
Okay. As you pointed out, we have not voted on the DE1 amendment, so Representative Beard will renew his motion to adopt the DE1 amendment. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Amendment is adopted. Now we are back on the bill as amended. Are there any additional questions for the author? Would you like to renew your motion?
Madam Chair, Speaker? Thank you again, committee, and I'd like to renew the motion that House File 2169 as amended today be recommended to pass and re-referred to the State Government Finance Committee.
All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay.
No.
Motion does prevail.
Thank you.
And the meeting is adjourned. Thank you.